Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso. How is everybody this evening?
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Minty Plucky. Fresh.
Conscious.
Conscious. That's a good one. That's a good one.
I look at you and I think, I don't know, furry. Furry. Burly.
Furly, furly?
Burly, furly.
Something we didn't mention, which happened yesterday as we record this, but a couple weeks ago now, is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
That's right.
Star Trek's first airing on CBS. And so happy birthday, Star Trek.
Happy birthday, Trek. Thank you for influencing us in great ways. And
You can now pre-order from ThinkGeek a Bluetooth communicator lapel pin that connects to your phone, and it makes a little chirping sound so you can answer and receive calls on the way Trekkies do.
That seems kind of silly because a Bluetooth is essentially that device that Uhura had in her ear anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So why put it on the lapel?
So you can look cool.
We already have that device that was inspired by the show to begin with.
So nerds at cons can talk on their phone.
But the... Oh, gosh. All right.
All right. Hey, friends. So I was thinking about buying versus borrowing comics because I'm not really much of a comic collector. So I'm like, I don't know what to buy and what to just like borrow to read and give back. But how do you guys deal with that? Like, I mean, you two work in a comic book store, so you don't actually have to buy any comics if you don't want to. How do you all, as a big comic book aficionados, make a decision to buy versus borrow?
Trial and error.
Yeah? After years and years of study. Yeah.
No, it's if I've read something, so from my standpoint of, yeah, I don't have to buy immediately. I can borrow some stuff and give it a quick read. But if I do get the feeling that I will read it again.
Mm. Yeah.
Then I know I want to buy that copy and hold on to it. And if I think I'm going to read it, you know, sometime within another year or two, then that's for sure.
Do you often reread comics?
Yeah, I try to make it a point to read books that I love, like Preacher, like once a year.
Oh, really?
Because I always kind of get something more each time. It's kind of the same with like Dune, the movie Dune. The first time I ever saw that, I think I was 10. And I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
And then I saw it again. I was like, I kind of got that. No, what's that? And you can do it again and again. And you finally, like, I kind of mostly got that movie down. Probably need to watch another 10 times. But so, yeah, like Preacher did that for me because first couple times I read it, I didn't know who Bill Hicks was. And there's a whole sequence in there where he talks about seeing Bill Hicks perform live.
Really?
And Bill Hicks had a message. And he actually, like... roll that into one of his characters. So,
and if you don't know Bill Hicks, please look him up right now. He's a wonderful, sadly dead human.
I should check Preacher out because Bill Hicks is one of my favorites.
It's a quick sequence kind of in the middle of the whole run where he meets somebody who served in Vietnam with his father.
Ah.
And then they're talking about stuff in a bar, and at some point he mentions Bill Hicks. And so the first couple times I was like, he mentioned thing, move on. But finally I was like, what? There's a lot of books I feel that it's worth to have, and some of it's also for the sake of having reference material too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes to like taking a leap of faith, I'm less leapy these days.
Yeah.
I like to upgrade things that I know that I love. And I like to, like, if I have the single issue format, then I get the soft cover. Then if I see a hardcover, I sell the soft cover, get the hardcover. And if I see a monster book that I can murder people with, I will upgrade to that.
Yeah.
All right.
And series I love, I'll get the singles monthly so I can somewhat keep up with them.
Right.
And then if there's a beautiful hardcover, I'll get that. Like Lumberjanes is what I do with that. I guess I'm doing that with Prince List, so I do that sometimes.
Any other considerations go into you deciding to buy something? Like, if something comes in and you see it on the shelf, you're like, I have to have this, bring it home with me.
I think before I worked here, a lot of it was based on recommendation because the world of comics is so big and sometimes hard to navigate, mostly hard to navigate, that, you know, just throw a few things at the wall, like I like this, that, and the other thing, and then it would be like, pshung, here's the comics you want to read. And then from there, get an idea of either writers or artists that I really like. Like, I will follow J.H. Williams III anywhere. Mm-hmm. I even have the Sandman stuff. I didn't read the Sandman stuff, but I bought it with my monies because it was him. I don't care about Sandman though. Sometimes I will just follow just blindly on that. If it's gay and glittery, I'll probably buy it. You know, so I kind of know my shticks as well.
I'm very much the same way.
He knows my glitter and gay, so he'll throw that at me sometimes too.
Aesthetics go a long way, and if it's a book of beautiful artwork that matches other books of artwork I have, then it's going on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And there have been things that I apparently have an autopilot that doesn't suck, because there have been things that arrived at the store and I see it on the invoice a week ahead. I'm like, why did I order 10 copies of this $30 hardcover? And then it comes in, I'm like, okay, I didn't know what you were, but apparently something worked in there. And I got a pretty cool book now. So yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
What about you, Cole? How do you make that distinction?
For a while there, I was a really good boy. I was being very conservative about, after collecting for how many decades, whittling my monthly titles down to like 5. And then getting trades from the library and, you know, not. And then I started doing this web series, and then I started doing this podcast. And then my impulse control has just gone into the crapper.
Maybe not as bad as maybe like years ago, right?
Okay, hold on, because I got a really great example of poor impulse control that I exercised just within the last week and a half. Okay. Researching the episode of the Ninja Turtles that we're going to be doing here real soon for the live show, I reread all the IDW books in the hardbound. I got those from the library, but you know, I kept reading all these really great things about the Batman, Ninja Turtles crossover, and my goodness, the first issue is already up to like 16, 18 bucks on eBay. And I'm like, I didn't even bother to look when the collected edition was coming out. I just like, you know, I can't help myself. And I bought it. And I didn't bother to look at the fact that the second issue went out of print probably even faster. And the second issue is now more valuable than the trade collected edition, which came out the same week that I bought the first issue and the rest of the lot. So I just spent like $35 on individual issues when I could have bought the hardbound edition for 3/4 of that. So I do, this is something I'm acknowledging.
Sometimes you got to phone a friend, man.
Yeah.
Who has access to the Diamond website, AKA me. I just,
you know, I was on my phone, I was at work, the urge came over me. I don't have a sponsor.
I'm your sponsor is what I'm saying. I'm your sponsor.
Piggybacking onto that.
Me and Galactus are here for you, man. The life bringer.
But at the same time, I still like to collect. Yeah. You know?
It's nice seeing those things on your shelf.
But also I like to collect individual issues.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was bagging up comics this weekend, and I was actually bagging up and boxing 2 years worth of comics. That have, you know, sorting them and bagging them, and I inevitably find issues that I'm missing. How that happens?
I know, right? It's magical.
And I'll go, but also I will pick up older comics, and I'm like, and I had Dead World from Caliber Comics back in the 80s, and this is the comic book that really, if you want to argue about it, inspired Kirkman to write Walking Dead. But, you know, actually, it's really just an extension of the story ideas that Romero gave us long ago. And it had a window of time where it was a really amazing independent comic book. And I'm like, they're not worth a lot.
No.
They have, who's doing the artwork? But, you know, I'm like, I want to collect all those. Mm-hmm. I want to collect all those. Mm-hmm. I never did that back in the day. They're not expensive, but it's going to add up. But I'm just really kind of OCD.
Well, we're all collectors in that way.
You mentioned bagging and boarding, too. Yeah. Like, am I the only one that if you're doing your personal collection, there's actually something kind of therapeutic about doing that.
Oh yeah,
I can see that.
Yeah.
It's tedious and it will take me like half a day, even if I don't have a lot of stuff. But I love just sitting and having like all my boxes out and getting the bags and boards and like looking through the stuff. And
I hate doing it in the store, but
no, but like
do you
your
feel
own.
Dirty? Do you feel dirty
collection?
When someone's watching you do that?
No,
I just don't want to do it. No, but
don't look at me. I'm fucking and boarding.
This is personal business.
Because I've just started organizing some stuff, looking to kill certain things. And there's certain things that I keep too that are like there is negative value to it. Like I have number one of the Defenders of Dynamo City, and no one knows what that book is, but it's one of the. It is the first book I bought on a stand by myself, and it has a monkey throwing banana bombs at people.
Done. Yeah.
But so, you know, stuff like that I keep, you know, certain runs of like, I love this run of Our Man. I love this run of Resurrection Man, stuff like that. So, you know, yeah, those nostalgia plays a heavy factor.
Yeah,
what stays and what doesn't stay.
Yeah.
You know.
And well, see, one of the evil things that you did to me in the course of our friendship was to remind me that it's probably a good idea, as he steeples his fingers together, to rebag and board things and take, because your comic books look nicer when you put them in, like, so I put them in, via your recommendation, I put them in Silver Age bags and board them, and they do. They look all mint and crispy, and I do that frequently. I'll pick my favorite comic books, dig them out, take a... You know, I am filling
your. Are you boarding your comics now?
Yeah.
Wow.
The ones I think are really special.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's usually only bags them.
But he did this to me. He did this to me. Yeah. It's all his fault.
Yeah, he did it to all of us, okay? Come on. No, I'm just kidding.
We need to form like a support group or something.
The Chris Casso's fault.
He's getting tweedly with his facial hair.
I'm making people take care of their things. How terrible.
Another aspect of, you know, whether you borrow it or not, we have book clubs here, and some people will choose to go to the library. Some will buy it. But, I mean, if you have a time factor on, like, when you want to try to read something, the lines can get really long at the library.
Right.
And if you're just really, really curious, sometimes it's just better to just grab it up. And also, who knows about print runs and all these kinds of things? Like, is it a mainstream title? Is it an indie title? Is it somewhere in between? You know, that is a factor in when I'm going to buy something. Mm-hmm. I'm like the Black Monday Murders single issue. I flat out bought that, even though I haven't read it yet, and I don't know if I like it. I probably will, but just because I'm like, I don't know if this is going to stay in print.
Never,
and
go
it
home.
Didn't.
Never Go Home.
Oh, We Can, like, Never Go Home.
Yeah,
that's from Black Mass.
I read a review of it on IO9. You guys had already talked about it. I was dialed out, apparently. And I read a review of it, and I was like, I need to have this comic book. I need to have it now, and I need to have all first prints.
Yeah, and that's
and
what I learned
about
Black Mask. Yeah, like, if you're interested, get them in singles, like, right away.
I went right on eBay, and I got them. So.
This is also a good example of, it doesn't hurt to find a comic book store where you can have a conversation with people and get a feel of if it's worth it or not, because the Black Monday Killers, there were a couple people that were kind of like, on the fence, and after I'd read it, I just basically, like, shoved it in their face. I'm like, no, there's no fence. Bye.
Just get it.
That's
another thing.
Now.
I mean,
just get over the fence now.
The recommendation thing can go a long way. Do you have a friend who's like, you would really dig this, then, you know, you either borrow it from them or you go out and buy it based on the recommendation.
For me right now, with Ben and I producing The Panel Jumper, one of the joys of this process is that I kind of dig immersing myself in whatever I'm looking into. And I, you know, he's the victim of that process because I will hand him a 16 page of steaming poop.
But I'm not allowed to call it steaming poop.
No, you are not. But that is, unfortunately, the end result of my enthusiasm for immersing myself into, you know, whatever. So, like, you know, I was rereading Ninja Turtles for the first time in decades and decades and having a ball with them. But I was also rereading all the Frank Miller Daredevils and looking at them through in the context of what the TV show looks like now. And I'm like, you know, but I tell you what, here's the thing. I am not going to go dig up those individual issues out of my boxes. I'm not going to do that.
That actually brings me to my next question for y'all. So you have all these collections, right? How do you determine what you keep in a box and what you want to display proudly on your shelf? Is it all basically just, I think I'm going to read this again, so I'm not going to put it away in a box? Or are there titles where you're like, yes, I want people, when they come over to my house, I want them to see that I have this? Is there anything that you own?
It's a little different because, like, you have, like, the trade paperback books, which can have some nice shelf appeal, which you're going to put anyway. Single issues are a little trickier because you bag and board them, you put them in a box. You don't generally, like, display them out. But for us, like, in my house, we'll have, let's say, the Spider-Gwen figure that came out for the Marvel Legends line by Hasbro, and I'll put the Edge of Spider-Verse Spider-Gwen issue that I have next to it and display it, and we'll have a little thematic thing going on.
Yeah.
I currently have a Batwoman section on my shelf where I have all the statues and little figures that I have thus far of Batwoman, and I put out one of the really cool Detective Comics issues. So, and those rotate out. So with singles, that will happen.
Whereas my home environment is the antithesis to that type of delicate interior design.
You have a lot of great display.
I'm kind of getting to the point where it's like, I don't know if I can have friends come over and play anymore.
Not until you clean your room.
Over here, welcome back, Carter style.
What's the matter, baby? What?
Mr. Carter.
Yo, you want to come over and play?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, well, I'm running out of room, and I just kind of like, and I am in a place right now where it's like, I don't want to purge. I can't think of anything I want to purge.
Yeah, I'm thinking of purging other items besides comics so I can fit more comics.
You are not getting rid of your horror high dolls. That's not going to happen.
No, that's not.
I've committed too much.
No, I have like 70 dolls, honey.
Putting that 70 doll collection.
It's been a community
together.
Event.
And when are those kids going to graduate anyway?
Never.
Fashion dolls never age. Go ahead.
So I basically have forced a rule in my own setup that if it cannot go onto a shelf, I shouldn't have it.
Hmm.
As far as trade paperbacks, graphic novels, hardcovers.
Right.
And because there's really no point. Like, the point of those is having accessibility and having them available and also for the display aspect. So what that requires sometimes is if something is and it can't fit, something else must die.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's I'm in a constant purge cycle of killing to make more room.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Anna Jones thing, and it's like, if I gotta replace the idol with something of equal weight.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to buy something big, something must go away.
Well, you really honor your living space as an ecosystem, which is something I quit doing a long time ago. You believe in nature red in tooth and claw, and I think I'm lazy.
I actually have the same sort of thing.
You are not lazy.
Limited shelf space.
Right.
And,
no, sir.
I can't fit more shelves in my apartment. So, like, if when this shelf is full, something else has to leave.
I've rearranged so many times for the most amount of shelf space possible, including things that should not be considered shelves becoming shelves.
There you go.
So,
like next to the TV on the TV stand.
Yeah. I will fight for any way to create that space before I have to kill book, but sometimes book must die.
Is print life a consideration? Because for where trades and graphic novels are concerned, I hold on to a lot of stuff solely because I know it's out of print.
Yes.
And I look at my shelves and I go, in fact, I had a bit of a panic when I was putting the research stuff together for one of our previous episodes, because I'm like, do I even have that anymore? And if I don't have it anymore, what happened? And I got really kind of Twitter-pated about it, like, because I know that's out of print and I know it's super duper expensive to try to replace it.
Yeah, I try to be very careful.
And did I loan it to Nicole?
And then she never gave it back.
I have my baseball card shelves.
Yes.
And it's one of these like heavy metal garage units that's got the steel beams on either side. And I'm almost out of room. I've been very good. I haven't bought baseball cards from eBay.
Because that tells me that you have a mightier collection than I anticipated.
It's grown pretty large. Yeah. For being such small things,
yes.
They take up a lot of room and are super heavy.
A lot of nights of scotch on eBay.
Yeah, no.
Recently, is that what?
See, I'd love to lay it down to come to an end. That this is the thing that Ben does. It's like, oh.
I almost want
human.
It to be like brandy, and you're like one finger clicking the buy button, one with the snifter.
I do need a breathalyzer for eBay.
He's in a smoking jacket. Yeah.
But here's the thing, and it's all about the display. So I have these unopened boxes of like cards that aren't worth anything, right? So what do I care? But I'm like, oh, I want to open these cards, but I also like, because the cards aren't. It's better to open the boxes than it is to leave the cards, because the gum is in there and it's ruining the cards. And they're bending in weird ways.
So I'm like, I want to open the boxes, but I like seeing the unopened boxes on the shelf. And so my lady friend was like, well, why don't you just open the cards and leave the boxes? And I'm like, that's different. The cards I was gonna be in there.
I was going to say, do you want me to craft you something so it looks very authentic, like there's cards still in there?
Like put something in there to just keep the box from collapsing upon itself.
Exactly,
you need to buy a shrink wrap machine.
I do. Oh my God.
See, there you go.
Anyway. So,
not the same woman.
Not the same. Also on my shelves are, I have a couple things where, like, I went through this period of, like, buying all the books of NPR monologists. So I have, like, I have all of David Sedaris. I have all of, like, Sarah Vowell's books, David Rakoff, all these people that I heard on NPR who I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe I'm a good Seattle liberal. I should probably have these on my bookshelf. And sometimes it might seem kind of pretentious. And
only if you haven't read them.
But I've read all of one. But anyway.
Okay, then that is pretentious.
Well, they're actually... There was one Sarah Vowell book I couldn't quite get through, but
he tried.
I wanna know, are there any, and I'm doing air quotes here, yes, pretentious comics? Like are there any comics there where you see someone reading
what does that mean to you?
It means that person is only reading that comic because that comic is a status symbol.
Oh.
I think that it comes down to who that person is.
Okay.
And not the books that should be judged.
Well, yeah, what's the subculture that's perpetuating?
Judge not, lest you be judged.
Because the thing is, like, so for an example, let's say you went and you met somebody who's just like, Batman, I love Batman. I'm the biggest Batman fan ever. And you go to their shelf and they have Dark Knight Returns, Year One, and Killing Joke. And that's like it. And it's just kind of like,
which I've seen before, yeah.
You know, but and that's the thing, though. It's like I've seen other collections where it's just like you have Kiya Asayama's Batman graphic novel that no one knows exists, or you know, I almost let that go. But or you know, you got Batman the Chalice, you got what you know, things that only saw like one print run and disappeared.
Yeah,
and it's just like that person actually probably does want to grab everything of Batman.
They are devoted.
They're devoted.
Well, there's like In the goth scene, the Sandman comics. If you don't read comics, you probably still have Sandman on your shelf.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
I've dated a couple goths in my day. I'm a dabbler of the gothic gothic world, but not goth enough to pass.
Yeah. You don't wear enough black.
Yeah, most of my outfits.
Oh,
black,
sidebar
whatever.
To this: if you want to have a good chuckle, go to gothsinhotweather.com. It's a bunch of goths maintaining their aesthetic in the extreme heat. It's awesome.
I appreciate that actually, but yeah, I mean, I think that would be one of those things that I mean, goth is pretentious in general. That's why I don't fit in the crowd. I'm not gothier than thou or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be one I would consider in that.
I didn't realize why I haven't read it, but I didn't realize it was big in the goth community. Sandman.
Yeah, I mean Neil Gaiman is a goth, isn't he? Pretty much.
But he's a charming goth, you know.
Well, I'm not saying it as a negative, because there are many goths, but you know, as far as the pretentious level,
there are many faces of the goth.
The level, the pretentious level that you get to of the goth.
No, that's a really, really good point. Is that? Books that sort of like create an aura of cool about you. You know, Alan Moore was like that. You know, if you were hip, you know, you may not have been into comics, but you've read Alan Moore.
Yeah.
Well, and I would think that certain books like the works of Daniel Clowes or
or
half of anything Fantagraphics published.
That Chris Ware.
It just kind of depends because I have so many customers that have come in and they're like, I only read that. You know, it's just like some of them, I think, do only read that because that's just their jam. But some of them, I think, buy it because they think that's a good jam to present.
Right.
And like, there's just some books that feel a little bit more like that because they're more considered art or literature than a superhero comic. I mean, we have a gentleman who visits from time to time, and he's just like, I just can't do the superhero stuff. Blah, blah, blah. And then he was just like, do you guys read them? And like the owner and I were just like, yeah. Nothing wrong with that, you know, and so he was, you know, trying to pass judgment or trying to like figure something out between us there, and it's just sort of like, yeah, you know, I mean, any genre is a genre. one's not necessarily better than the other. Like what you like. Mm-hmm. But you could tell some people just kind of get harder on some genres.
Yeah.
And then they want to promote certain ways that makes them look cool.
Yeah.
You know.
By also playing down all the other stuff.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, I guess at that point it really can be subjective. And then it can also invade subcultures as well. Like, you know.
Yeah. It's funny because I was just having this conversation earlier with a friend of mine about the definition of being a hipster. And to me, that definition was a hipster is someone who's defined by the media that they consume. And so I'm wondering, like, if there are, like, hipster comics. You know, yeah. like if you saw someone who, you know, they've got the waxed mustache and their black rim glasses, smoking a pipe. You know, standing in the school courtyard.
Do they vape now?
They probably vape. Oh my God.
Well, you know, I would argue that any book that has inspired a successful a film or television series, like I was looking at Walking Dead. You know, that was a moderate seller when it came out, but then within the first season of the show, the first issue of that comic book shot up to over $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a limited print run. But, you know, they also had reprinted them. So there was, like, this cool factor of being... And I could not believe that any comic book collector in the main could afford to buy a $1,500
right.
copy of Walking Dead number one. But someone else who came in as part of the bandwagon... with who's in a different income. Am I making up stories? Maybe I'm just making up stories from different income bracket. You know, that would make, because that would make them hip. They were buying their cool. Yeah. Does that make sense?
We've had some people who were bragging about, you know, selling their Walking Dead number ones. They had multiple
copies.
Yeah, well,
I did that.
That sort of thing.
But I only had one copy.
But you immediately lamented it, so.
We get a lot of back issue braggarts, too. Uh-huh. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it happens all over
okay.
the place.
Okay,
all
right. It's a toughie with comics. It's a toughie with comics. I mean, I could totally see how, you know, something in some other form of literature, like the guy that you know, that's drug around James Joyce's Ulysses for like 5 years and only read, you know, 10 pages of it because having that book on his person is going to make him look cool, you know. That's more along the lines, I think, of what you're talking about. But I don't know if comics, it's a toughie.
All right. Well, let's ruminate on that in our own private time, but let's move on to book report, everybody. And let's start with Chris. What do you want to tell us about?
I just picked up Frank Cho's Skyborn from Boom Studios. It's a 5-issue miniseries that he is writing and drawing, created, written, and illustrated by Frank Cho, colored by Marcel Menez, and lettered by Ed Dukeshire.
Not Ed Dukeshire!
Dukeshire!
It's, I am a fan of Frank...
The Bostonian Bookshires?
Yeah. Is that a thing? I don't understand what you guys are doing.
We are just riffing.
We okay. just like the name Dukeshire. Perhaps he works with Bonvillain.
Bonvillain!
Anyway.
Oh, you mean Harvey Bonvillain?
Yes. So I do like Frank Cho. I think he can be a very good storyteller. Sometimes I think his art is stronger than his writing. This is a case where there's not enough to quite figure out exactly where he's going with it, but it is engaging. It's kind of a possibly supernatural thriller. He gives you a lot of stuff that just makes you curious what's going to happen next. Mm. So in that respect, he's really, really good at bringing a reader in. And his figures are great as usual. He draws some interesting different types of, well, man, there's only one woman. And it's pretty violent. He does do some things that annoy me, where he's pretty sparse with some of his paneling, and you kind of get some what I consider wasted space, but I think he considered interesting design elements. They bring in Excalibur, and I think Merlin just popped up. But again, there's just not too much because it's focused more on the action. It's a brisk read. It doesn't feel like a ripoff. But it is a quick read, and I think A lot of Boom things, I think, read better as a trade. Mm-hmm. I think this will be one of those things.
Now, is he off Totally Awesome Hulk, or is he?
Yeah.
Is he?
Okay. Yeah, he doesn't stay on that stuff very long.
He doesn't stay on anything too long. So, yeah, it's worth noting that his main field protagonist, once again, looks like Linda Carter. or like Brandy from Liberty Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
Or every other woman he's ever drawn. She looks great. But, yeah, so it's... What is it, $3.99? Yeah, it's an interesting read. If you like Frank Cho, you will like this, I think. There's probably going to be a dragon at some point.
Ooh.
All right, Skyborn by Frank Cho. Thanks, Chris. Mm-hmm. Nicole, what do you want to tell us about?
I read Generation Zero, which is a new title from Valiant Publishing, or Valiant Entertainment. It is written by Fred Vanlente, art by Francis Portella. Color art, that's just another way for saying colorist, is Andrew Dalhouse. I want to say Dalhouse.
So we got Bond villain and Dalhouse?
Yes! Our team is shaping up nicely. So this is a team book. The Generation Zero are a team of Zyots, which is another word for like mutants or superheroes, superhumans or metahumans or whatever. And they're people born with potential incredible abilities. So it gives you this spread of different characters. They're all teenagers or kids. And they've escaped. They were created as like weapons of war, and they escaped and decided to do their own thing and be heroes. So it focuses on this one character, Keisha. And she's kind of a gothy girl. She finds like the love of her life, and she's surprised because he drives his car into a tree and dies. And she's just like, wait, what? What? And she surprisingly takes it very well, but then I guess has a breakdown later. So the whole setup actually is where a bunch of kids can try to get in contact with Generation Zero and ask them for help. And, you know, they might get picked and, you know. I don't know. What else should
I
add to
this? And she's trying to contact them because she thinks it's fishy that her boyfriend died by means that he never
Thank
would
you.
Die.
That's what I was missing. I was like, I am missing something. We are at the end of the night here. So anyway, she goes to a party and she ends up meeting up with some kids, and some Slendermen show up or something. Some colonial Slendermen. So there's certainly something fishy happening. And I thought the setup of this was really interesting. The art was really, really good. I liked Portella as an artist. And so I hope that him and Fred Vanlente are just going to stay consistently on the title. And yeah.
Did you like his voice for the generation?
Yeah. Does I mean, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get too much of a feeling of who they are exactly. They sort of show up at the end there.
I mentioned that because I read this as well, and I brought it up to Nicole and a coworker of ours that I just realized that virtually every book about, because this is Gen 13, this is Teen Titans, every book about a teen generation is always written by the generation that precedes it. And how is that translated? Because Gen 13 that's going to be Jim Lee co-creating along with Brandon Choi and a few other guys. They were too old to be considered that generation. There's never been a teen book written by the generation to represent it.
Yeah, that's a toughie.
The only one actually would be Legion of Superheroes by Jim Shooter, because that boy started working in comics when he was 13.
That's right.
Wow.
He was working legally.
Yep.
Well, and then I can't really speak to that because I'm not of this generation.
Right.
I'm 33 years old. I'm not in high school anymore. But when I was in high school, I could relate to Keisha. As far as just being kind of an other sort of alternative girl, gothy, whatever. I didn't find the love of my life, who was extremely attractive in high school. That happened way later, but you know.
All righty.
So does this fit, how does it fit into the rest of the Valiant universe? Is it interconnected?
Because Psyots are what Harbinger and Faith are.
Yeah.
So this is Gen 13 for their
got it.
You know, their Teen Titans.
Well, what I'm you know, I've been sporadically picking up Valiant trades of the more recent Valiants, but I've also been reading some older ones from the library, thanks to reading Faith. And one of the Faith miniseries, I have not read any of the new ongoing series yet. But one of the things that really started to concern me about Valiant, and I, you know, what did I read? Archer and Armstrong, the first two Harbinger books, can't think of what else. Enjoyed them, but they're really white. Those stories are really white, and they're written by white people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see a lot of people of color in any of these stories. Mm-hmm. And that was, and I was trying to get, and you guys, please argue with me. But I was looking at the rest of the Valiant universe. Yes, we're kind at this table.
Sure.
But looking at this, I'm seeing more people of color, which pleases me.
Yeah. I would say they don't have a lot of people of color necessarily. Yeah. That is still
the Divinity character is probably one of their bigger
examples.
So they could definitely work more on that.
Yeah.
So
for
you're
sure.
in agreement with me
for
on this
sure.
one.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Cool. All right. Mm-hmm. Generation Zero from Valiant. Thanks, Nicole. And Cole Hornaday, what do you want to tell us about?
I picked up, this is it's called The Man-Thing by Steve Gerber Complete Collection. This is volume one. It came out about a year ago. Volume two, I think, is going to be hitting the stores this in November. So this is a collection. This is not one of those like Marvel Essential Editions that's a black and white phone book edition. This is a nicely, it's a paperback, nicely reproduced, slick paper, color reprints of not just, actually, this is a, it's kind of misleading because this first volume is not just Steve Gerber's stories. It's everything.
Yeah.
It's his appearances. It's Man-Thing's first appearance in Creatures on the Loose or whatever it is. Savage Tales and Adventure into Fear. You know, Gerber's stories don't start until like maybe about a quarter of the way into the book.
And you have to be careful with these collections because at a certain point they move on from Steve Gerber. They do different things.
Yeah.
Like they did that with the Howard the Duck too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're right, but he, you know, going into that, I knew that that Gerber had only written like the first 24 issues of Howard, so I was not surprised. Mm-hmm. This actually surprised me. I'm totally cool with it because I've never read a lot of these Man-Thing stories, but I've read about them for a long time. Case in point was, you know, Gerber was just a nutburger, and he did more nutburgery things than just Howard, and he just like went kind of all bat poop when he got his hands on Man-Thing. And case in point is this story in Adventure into Fear, number 17, where he basically recreates Superman in the guise of a character called Wundar. And Wundar, and DC got, do you remember it?
I remember
the
Wundar.
The Wundar story? Yeah. And DC, they tried to threaten a lawsuit, but it was, you know, it's such an obvious ripoff of Superman done satirically, but maybe
parody.
Not. because you kind of, I read it, I'm like, oh, well, no wonder they were upset about this story, because Wundar is Superman. He gets, his origin is the ending of Krypton, but the distinction is that he doesn't escape, his spaceship crashes in the swamp, and he doesn't escape the capsule as a baby. In fact, he's stuck in there into adulthood until Swamp Thing, like, knocks over the rocket ship, and he comes out, and he's like, he sees Swamp, or it's not Swamp Thing, excuse me, Man Thing, and he's like, Mommy! You know, so then it gets really super weird.
Oh my God.
But I'm like, this is so fun. I'm thoroughly digging this collection. It is very much a product of its time. But having, you know, done the research I did for the Howard the Duck episode that we produced, I'm thoroughly enjoying, you know, finally having an opportunity to read the rest of these. Unfortunately, this collection is not cheap. It is dense, it is exhaustive, but it's close to $40 for this trade.
Wow.
And
Marvel books are pretty expensive.
Yeah. I got this one used in very nice condition for about half that, but I don't know that I would have paid for full price on the newsstand or, you know, yeah, in the bookstore. But I got to tell you, I am thoroughly enjoying it. It's you know, there are artists like Mike Ploog and people like that, and all of Gerber's weird characters like the Fool Killer and Howard. It's got all the original Howard's, you know, appearances and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm having a good time with it.
All right. Cool. Man Thing.
Man Thing by Steve Gerber, The Collection, Volume 1.
I think.
Steve Derberger.
Man Thing by Steve Gerber, The Collection, Volume 1. Yeah, the editor on this one needed to be spanked.
All right. So thanks, Cole. And that is Book Report, and that's our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And by Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or at perfectboundpodcast.com. Yeah, or go to paneljumper.com. It's all on my website.
Visit us on Facebook. Come and like us
on Facebook. Like the Comics Dungeon on Facebook as well. And as we previously said, Cole puts a lot of comic geek links on the Panel Jumper's Facebook page.
Barely. It's geeky links,
which is where I get most of my comic book news. And on the page that I created. Anyway, leave us a review on iTunes if you want. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. But now everybody get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. And this week the questions come to us from Mr. Chris Casale.
This is kind of a sequel to a previous theme of mine, because I had just tossed into the Phantom Zone. We also talked about Batman tossing thing into the Batcave. So this one is just toss it on the moon. I'm a fan of just people leaving their garbage around. So, on one of the many, many, many occasions that the Justice League Watchtower base on the moon was attacked, a chunk of their bathroom was blown off and the remains sit mostly intact. In that bathroom, there's a bit of graffiti tagged in that says, "Tommy was here." Who is this Tommy? It's Weedy. I'm just trying to teach things about the moon.
Who is Tommy? Who's Tommy? Now, I know what that is. So who's Tommy?
Tommy, can you hear me? Oh, dude, you got me. I don't know.
Tommy Monahan, the hitman.
Oh, jeez.
That's right. All right.
The moon makes for a good neutral meeting place, as seen on the occasion of Dr. Doom meeting a famous monster to negotiate a non-aggression pact at the lunar rover site. Who is the famous monster?
Ping, pang, boom.
Dracula.
On the moon?
Dracula and Dr. Doom on the moon. They actually
that is so weird.
They made a poster image of that for comics, and they were just like, Dracula and Dr. Doom on the moon. You should read this book.
When was that story?
Captain Britain and M13.
Oh, that's weird.
If you're not careful, you might accidentally step on a talking skull named Hooker, still screaming obscenities on the lunar surface. Hooker was punted there by Mitchell Shelley, also known as the unusual superhero named...
He's got a great kick, I'll give him that. Mm-hmm.
Not the Sportsmaster.
Resurrection Man.
Oh, that was Resurrection Man. See, you and I are part ways on that series. You loved it. I thought it was...
The original series.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, Justice League aren't the only ones who have made a base on the moon to see it destroyed. The Silver Age B-list villain turned ancient demon of vengeance saw his moon citadel collapse in a 90s crossover event called The Darkness Within. Who is this villain?
Don't know.
Come on, dude, you're the only one.
I know.
Actually, you and so me. In the Chris told me all of these things.
Okay, then why aren't you helping? Why aren't you helping? You could have been coaching me the whole long.
Sleeping right okay. now. Okay, it's gone into sleep mode.
Yes, Eclipso.
Of course it is. Of course it is. With this little purple crystal gem.
And it's all moon-based stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Last one.
All right.
The blue area of the moon sees a lot of action.
Yes, it does.
From the likes of the X-Men, the Inhumans.
People die there.
The Inhumans, the Watcher, and more. But who originally built it?
Who built the Inhumans?
No.
The Kree.
Because
I think I actually read this once, but I don't remember who it is. But it
the blue like area of the moon.
The Skrulls built it over a million years ago, while the Kree built the Blue City, which is often seen in the ruins that everybody fights on.
Yes.
And the Kotati built a complex yet subtle ecosystem.
All right, I was wrong. I did not read that because that all sounded foreign to me.
You said Kotati.
Yes, it's
just Kotati.
Kotati.
It's the Kotati.
Alrighty, well, that's thank you very much, Chris.
We learned so much.
We did learn a lot.
We did. Good Kotati to you too.
We learned so much, and I think we grew a little bit as well. So thank you for listening.
Everybody.
Happy Kotati. We'll see you next week.
Happy Kotati.